We're about 7 months from Election Day, and while the battle lines may seem drawn, there's a lot that still happens between now and November 5th. We're talking with reporters covering the healthcare policy stories that are making news.
I want to jump on the abortion issue because I think that is really going to be huge. We've seen in states where abortion has been on the ballot, it's really played out. People have turned out to vote, and it's been a lot in the Democrats' favor. So I'm sure the Republicans are watching that and figuring out how they can spin the issue.
We read their coverage and respect their knowledge. Now we're going to learn more about their analysis and their insights.
It's hard to say with Trump whether anything he says is actually going to happen one way or the other. But he seems interested, at least he's saying he seems interested in a 15-week ban or a 16-week ban. He seems to sort of want to, as he says, essentially just like please everybody.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, we welcome our guest to Conversations on Healthcare. It's good to see you all. You know, there are distinguished journalists like yourself who are known for great reporting, and we so appreciate you making the time. We have Joyce Frieden, who oversees MedPage Today's coverage of Washington and health policy. Ben Leonard is a healthcare reporter at Politico and focuses on policy and politics in Congress. And Nathaniel Wexel is the health policy reporter for The Hill. I'm wondering if we could start out with a topic for all of you to address the presidential elections. President Biden, of course, will be the nominee for the Democrats and former President Donald Trump for the Republicans. Biden has called for extending a subsidy boost under the Affordable Care Act that's set to end after 2025 in former President Trump is again an opponent to the ACA. There's also the Dobbs decision that overturned a constitutional right to an abortion. I'm wondering, do you see this playing out as a healthcare election? And will healthcare be a defining issue for who wins in November? Who'd like to take that?
I want to jump on the abortion issue because I think that is really going to be huge. We've seen in states where abortion has been on the ballot, it's really played out. People have turned out to vote, and it's been a lot in the Democrats' favor. So I'm sure the Republicans are watching that and figuring out how they can spin the issue. And there are just so many other abortion, healthcare-related issues on the ballot. There's on the ballot, but healthcare generally, I think, is on people's minds. Access to healthcare and the high price of prescription drugs, which the Biden administration has taken some actions on. So I don't know it'll be the top thing on everybody's mind, but I think it'll be there.
Mm-hmm. Ben?
I think it really depends on who you're asking, you know, in terms of, you know, Republican voters, healthcare isn't, you know, nearly as high as for Democrats. You know, top issues for Republicans are things like the economy, immigration, where for Democrats, issues like healthcare, abortion are, you know, significantly higher. And I think it'll be interesting to watch on the abortion issue, like you mentioned, Joyce. A lot of these state referendums, we've seen a juice turnout. A lot of them have been very successful, but it hasn't necessarily translated down the ballot as much. So it'll be interesting to see if Democrats will be able to sort of change that trend going forward.
Yeah, I mean, to sort of add in on that, there's been a lot of polling that shown, you know, healthcare generally, issues like abortion specifically, they draw Democratic turnout. But for some of the swing voters, for Republican voters, you know, again, healthcare, abortion isn't necessarily going to be the driver. So it could help bring out the base, but it might not necessarily work so well on some of the swing voters. But to that end, like, the Biden administration has been sort of trying to paint healthcare as a pocketbook issue to win over some of these sort of the swing voters who care about costs. So, you know, they're trying to highlight, they're lowering the cost of prescription drugs, they're lowering the cost of insulin, they're, you know, doing things to just make it clear that healthcare is more than just this abstract thing. It's really about how much you're paying out of pocket.
That's great. And Joyce, IVF, does that change the equation as well, sort of shifting away from abortion, thinking about that issue?
Yeah, I do think so. I think that recent election win in Alabama, I think a lot of people were watching that. And it was sort of, I think that IVF thing was all about the unintended consequences of both abortion laws and judicial decisions.
Well, before we leave the topic, I think I just want to ask the question. We've been hearing through some reporting from The Hill and others that it was, you know, very possible that the president would propose, the former President Trump would propose a 15-week national abortion ban going into the election. And I think what I'm hearing from you all is maybe yes, maybe no. Anyone want to just take that one as a very specific headline grabbing, I would say, kind of proposal if it happened? Anyone think that's going to happen?
It's hard to say with Trump whether anything he says is actually going to happen one way or the other. But he seems interested. At least he's saying he seems interested in a 15-week ban or a 16-week ban. He seems to sort of want to, as he says, essentially just like please everybody. You know, I'm going to propose something to make everybody happy, which you can't actually do on abortion. So that sort of remains to be seen. A lot of the people that I've talked to, it would not seem like smart politics for him to stake out a position in advance of the election, because and no matter what he says, it's going to be used against him either by Democrats or even by some of the more right-wing anti-abortion groups.
You know, Ben, you reported the Supreme Court seemed quite skeptical of the lawsuit challenging the FDA's decision that loosened access to abortion pills. While we await the court's decision, tell us what you know about the anti-abortion movement trying new approaches.
Yeah, so just, you know, one part, this court case is just one part of a larger strategy to try to restrict access to abortion. You know, one of the prongs that we reported on was, you know, they're planning a lot of protests, trying to, you know, get things going in the grassroots, preparing potential executive orders for a second Trump administration if that comes, including one that would direct the FDA to pull its approval for mifepristone. You know, the Comstock Act, which some justices mentioned, you know, is also a potential route, although, you know, maybe not as likely, but, you know, it's something that's being looked at. And, you know, a lot of these groups, these anti-abortion groups, are looking at model legislation in the states to, you know, try to further restrict access. So it's, you know, beyond this court case, there are a lot of other things going on that these activists are working on.
Well, Nathaniel, let me turn to you. Congress finally passed, it seems like forever, a $1.2 million federal budget. I'm sorry, did I say million? $1.2 trillion federal budget. Little mistake there. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services received basically kind of flat funding. We were glad to see Congress extend the PEPFAR program to combat HIV and AIDS in other countries. That was something we had talked to Dr. Fauci about on the show just a few months ago. Yes, I'd like to ask you, Nathaniel, were there any winners in this budget, in the fighting and the dealing that went on, perhaps behind the scenes? Were there any winners that emerged?
I think you can say the fact that there was essentially flat funding, if not even like a slight boost, makes all of healthcare, all of HHS sort of a winner. Because there was also a very real possibility that there would have been an across-the-board cut. So the fact that Congress was able to come to some sort of agreement to not just pass, you know, continuing resolution after continuing resolution, but to come to some sort of agreement, I mean, I think you can argue that sort of makes the entire healthcare industry, healthcare, you know, as a whole, was sort of the winner. But, you know, PEPFAR was extended for, you know, 1 year, which is not what a lot of the advocacy groups were looking for. But, you know, again, 1 year is better than no years. So I think they're going to probably count that as a win.
And Nathan, you also reported that Congress held off on making controversial health changes to the pharmacy benefit manager industry. What does some want to see fixed, and when could it happen?
Yeah, really, it sort of boils down to just the business practices of PBMs. A lot of the anti-PBM movement is sort of talking about how PBMs are taking over the small pharmacies, the mom and pop pharmacies, and they're really just sort of making it much more difficult. They're talking about the fees that PBMs make and sort of just how PBMs can come between patients and their medicine. So there's a lot of changes that people are looking for. And part of the problem, I think, is that there were too many changes across too many different committees in Congress, is sort of what it's boiled down to. So lots of changes across lots of different committees. It's possible that some of these changes do get worked out towards the end of the year, but as you mentioned, it did not pass this time.
Well, Ben, I wonder if you'd answer this maybe theoretical question. Is there any way to get over these annual budget delays? They cause so much uncertainty. They really wreak a lot of havoc in planning in the healthcare sector. The next federal fiscal year starts October 1. And are there any proposals on the table to maybe structurally deal with these annual delays?
Yeah, I mean, we're closing in on another one, you know, just in less than 6 months. I think, and not unless there are wholesale fundamental changes to the American system, you know, other countries have other ways of doing this, you know, where essentially the government is forced to resign if they don't pass a budget. And, you know, I don't see anything like that happening anytime soon in the U.S. system. It's just it's the way that it works. I think a lot of it will just depend on, you know, the composition of Congress and going forward. And even there's been a fair amount of inter-party conflict, particularly in the Republican Party in this Congress. So, you know, even a larger majority may not, you know, necessarily, you know, lessen the likelihood of a shutdown and, you know, depending on the situation.
You know, Ben, we read with interest your story about healthcare sector's use of artificial intelligence as a clinical tool. Which raises a new question. Who's liable if the system makes a mistake? I'm wondering if you could tell us about it.
Yeah, it's a really, you know, controversial topic right now that a lot of the healthcare sector is trying to still figure out. You know, the American Medical Association is saying that it's already seeing AI come up in liability cases, and they're asking for, you know, doctors are asking for protection against liability if AI to a case that ends up getting, you know, them in trouble. And they have some allies in Congress who have been pushing the FDA for some sort of safe harbor for doctors and software makers if they have issues. On the other side of the equation, tech companies and some hospitals have sort of a different view of this, where, you know, they say doctors are making the final calls and are ultimately responsible, even if the software pushes them in the wrong direction. And some groups are calling for, you know, another sort of idea of shared responsibility within the healthcare system, depending on, you know, how much the provider knows or, you know, what abilities they have. So it's really, it's sort of an open question going forward how this is going to play out. A lot of proposals and not really any consensus right now.
Well, you did a nice job of covering the areas. Certainly radiology is one that's already benefited, not necessarily from AI, but machine learning. But everything is nowadays grouped under AI. Almost every story has an AI component to it, whether it's true or not. People have connected. But it was a great article. Thanks so much.
Well, then we'll just continue on this AI question for a moment. And Joyce, you had a great interview about NIH, the National Institute of Health, using AI to develop potential treatments. Tell us what you learned from Joni Rutter of the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. That was a fun interview. And just mentioning about AI, I was talking to a coworker this morning about whether we should call it augmented intelligence or artificial intelligence, because people seem to have two different definitions for the same abbreviation. Uh-huh. But Joni, one of the things she was talking about that she seemed most excited about was this thing called the Biomedical Data Translator. It's actually in beta mode, and you can go online and find it and ask it a question. But what it does is it's a compilation of about 150 databases, everything from genetic information to everything in PubMed to any other medical database you can imagine. And using artificial intelligence, they put together a way for researchers to ask it questions about potential treatments. And the example that she gave that kind of floored me was, and I hate to say, I hope nobody's eaten lunch, it was a patient with cyclic vomiting syndrome, which is a rare disorder, but very disabling. And these researchers had this woman who just couldn't keep weight on and had all sorts of problems. And so they asked the translator what might be a possible treatment for this. And it was a complicated answer with gene upregulation, but basically the answer came back, isopropyl alcohol, not to ingest, but they put isopropyl alcohol on a cotton swab and had this woman sniff it whenever she felt like she was going to get sick, and it worked. And so it was the kind of thing that, answer you wouldn't expect.
Wow, so astonishing, at a cost of about a hundredth of a penny.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was amazing. Well,
speaking of people who would be lined up to ask it questions, or certainly the group that you covered at a rally of long COVID patients on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and they're upset that there's no FDA-approved medications and there's no treatment, but it is really accurate for these patients to get the government focused back in on long COVID. And we've heard from so many people that we've interviewed over a long period of time that the government really is not doing making the type of expenditures that it did initially with the launch of the vaccine. What can you tell us about what's happening with long COVID and the hopeful investments that people are waiting to be made in this area?
Well, yeah, I can tell you, I did cover this rally, which was in front of the Lincoln Memorial a couple of weeks ago. And these long COVID patients are really frustrated, as you said, no cure available, nothing on the horizon. And so they've developed a whole list of goals and things they want to see the federal government do, such as declaring long COVID a national emergency and implementing the same kind of emergency use authorization that they did for COVID vaccines for any kind of long COVID treatment or trials. They want establishment of funding for annual funding for long COVID treatment programs. They want more public tracking of SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater, because that's something that's kind of gone by the wayside, is the tracking of the illness. And they want regular communication from the White House. They just feel ignored. I asked how many people they estimate are there with long COVID, and the figure they keep hearing is 18 million, but they think it's a vast underestimate because people, A, don't always know when they have it, and B, it's underreported.
We should let our audience know that we've had a number of guests on, one who was heading up an NIH longitudinal study on long COVID at, I believe, Margaret, NYU was the lead on that. I think they had up to 15,000 people under it, but we need more of those happening. There's just not enough. Joyce, did you pick up anything in the budget around long COVID at this cycle?
I actually didn't, and I need to delve deeper into that and find out what they are planning to do with it.
Perfect. Well, Joyce, let me just stick with you for a moment more, because I know that you're covering news from Washington, but you're also keeping your eye on activity in the states, certainly Alabama and the IVF controversy, but also Texas, which is in the news pretty regularly on issues of health and health-related things. You've been following the controversy, or the advocates calling for the Texas Medical Board to provide more clarification around medical exceptions to the Texas abortion ban. What's happening in Texas currently, and how much of a quandary is it causing for people and healthcare providers?
Yeah, it is so interesting. So Texas, as you probably know, has this 6-week abortion ban, no exceptions for rape or incest, but there's an exception to save the life of the mother. And this, of course, came up in this recent court case of a woman who was 20 weeks pregnant, found out that her fetus had a terrible anomaly. The doctor recommended abortion, especially because it was going to put her life at risk if she carried the pregnancy to term. And the court actually turned her down. She ended up going to, she sued to get permission, but the court said no, and she ended up going to another state. But in his decision, the judge suggested that it would help if the Texas Medical Board could better clarify what constitutes an abortion to save the life of the mother. Uh-huh. So the medical board put out a set of proposed regulations very recently, and I interviewed the president, and he said, you know, people are mad at me because I didn't say in this medical situation with this particular disease, then you can do, you know, an abortion to save the life, because it depends on so many things, including where you are geographically. Mm. If you don't have this ECMO machinery because you're in a rural area, you know, you may need to do one thing, whereas if you're in an urban area, you may need to do something else. Mm-hmm. So doctors should be glad that we didn't make it more specific.
Right.
But these are proposed guidelines, and they're waiting for people to weigh in. So people have like a month or more to comment on them.
Ben, I watched your interview with Representative Brad Wenstrup, a Republican from Ohio who previously had a long career as a doctor. He's supporting a bill that would expand Medicare coverage to include the new weight loss drugs. I'm wondering, tell us what the bill would do and how does his endorsement as a doctor help it in the halls of Congress?
Yeah, it was a great conversation with him. It's a bill that's been gaining a lot of momentum since Congress banned Medicare from covering obesity drugs in 2003. The type of treatments just weren't as good back then as we're seeing now, weren't as promising as some of the results we're seeing from some of these drugs. I think the biggest obstacle for it is the cost. There have been a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, including Bill Cassidy, who's a member on the Health Committee. It's really gotten a lot of strong bipartisan support, but I think the cost question.
Yeah, he was talking about ways to count other savings in that too. I think from the preventative side which was an interesting approach on the Republican side.
Yeah, totally. And there's a bipartisan push to reform sort of how the CBO looks at preventing the savings from care too. It House, I believe, unanimously. To expand the budget window to 30 years instead of 10, require the CBO to further out, which I think could also be a boost there. It'll be interesting to see, you know, the impact of, you know, if Congress does lift ban on, the cost of the healthcare system generally. The CBO said it would raise premiums, but it's also said that the drug could be subject to Medicare negotiation within the next couple of years, which, you know, makes sense given the price and the amount of spending that's already we're already seeing on these drugs. One of them's in the top 10 in gross spending already, and that could continue to rise given the recent approval of or CMS guidance saying that it can be covered in some circumstances. So I think we're just seeing more and more, momentum for this sort of legislation, more and more, you know, patients seeing access to these drugs in Medicare.
Well, it's certainly going to have huge ripple effects through the country in terms of just regular employee insurance and everything that affects healthcare based on what they decide about that. So we'll keep a close eye on it. And Joyce, I want to come back to you for a minute. It looks like you're as intrigued as we are with the new ARPA-H initiative, not so new anymore, but you've reported on things as diverse as how it's aiming to change how we deliver healthcare in rural areas to perfecting whole eye transplants. How are they picking their initiatives and how broad is their reach? Does it encompass everything in both delivery and in clinical practice? Tell us more about what they're up to.
Yeah, it is a pretty broad reach. I'm glad you specifically mentioned those two programs because I think it gives us a sense of what it is they're doing. The Paradigm program that you mentioned with the rural health clinics, you know, you think about people doing the little mobile vans to go places and give vaccines or mammograms, but they are talking big. They are talking about basically like a whole mobile hospital unit that would come to people. And so you could have a virtual visit or you could have an in-person visit and you could get your MRI and your CT scan. And so they are looking for big proposals from people On that, and similar, as you mentioned, to the whole eye transplants, you know, they that one, I guess, when people normally donate their eyes, you know, the doctors take a piece, they take a cornea and they'll transplant that. But they haven't been looking at the whole eye as a transplant vehicle. And they seem to be kind of searching for those whole big ideas. I'm still in the process of delving into what other areas they're at, but it is a very wide spectrum, for sure.
Well, let me close with a question for whomever wants to jump in. And first of all, let me just preface it by saying you all are doing a great job of educating Americans, but I guess the question is, why do so few Americans really understand what's happening with healthcare, an issue that they say they care a lot about? A Kaiser Foundation health tracking poll found that only 1/3 of Americans know about the Affordable Care Act's impact on lowering the rate of uninsured, and only 1/3 realize the ACA has hit an all-time high rate of enrollees during the recent open enrollment period. I'm wondering, from your vantage point as folks who are illuminating, shining that important light on the issue, how can we all help more Americans understand healthcare issues?
Well, if I could jump in, I would like to say that I think it is a matter of personalization. I can think of more than one member of Congress, for example, who became interested in an issue and advocated for it if it had to do with something that happened in their own family. And I think that we need to do a lot of this personalizing of stories, like when you're talking about a prescription drug shortage, instead of starting out with numbers, you start out with the patient, the cancer patient sitting there with their oncologist, and they both know what the best treatment is, but the person can't get it. And I just feel like that seems to go a long way toward at least getting people started on an issue.
Yeah, I think getting people, you know, involved and feeling like they have a stake in it too. And, you know, healthcare is obviously a complicated system, and, you know, a lot of people might ask, what's in it for me, you know, and, you know, why should I care? So I think, you know, getting ways to having, you know, in coverage, emphasizing, you know, how it is a pocket, how certain issues are pocketbook issues, I think has resonated, at least in our coverage, and has garnered more interest. So I think, you know, and you see that in political messaging as well. You know, the Biden administration likes to talk about a lot of the cost of living issues, you know, in terms of healthcare and like say the insulin cap, things like that. So I think that's like one way that people are doing that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the Affordable Care Act is sort of this big all-encompassing idea that, you know, a lot of people don't quite understand what it actually is. So if you can say like, oh, you know, there's this policy about lowering prescription drug costs, or there's this, you know, sort of breaking it down into individual sort of messaging bites, right? Like, I think people might not know what the Affordable Care Act is, or they might not know what it does, but, you know, they might know, oh, you know, I can't be discriminated against for pre-existing conditions, or you know, I know that the cost of my insulin is going down, but they might not understand why. So I think also, you know, personalization, but also, you know, making sure we really explicitly like connect the dots on a lot of those things can go a long way to help people.
Great. Well, I want to thank each of you for joining us. We know that the next 7 months will go quickly, and we will be following your writing. Thanks to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube and find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. As always, you can go online to chcradio.com, sign up for email updates, and please always feel free to share your thoughts and comments about this program. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Ben, Nathaniel, Joyce, really good to see you all. Thanks for all the great work.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.